Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Former Daily Show reporter John Oliver's fake news show on HBO is bucking the odds. Just 6 months after its debut, Last Week Tonight is beating Real Time with Bill Maher in the ratings. John Oliver is arguably surpassing his former Comedy Central colleagues for going beyond the low-hanging fruit of the daily headlines and outdoing network news at digging deeper into stories that don't get much attention or time in mainstream journalism. This despite John Oliver's protest that it is not a news show, but a comedy show first and second. So what happens when comedy meets investigative journalism? That's the question that Aswin Soupsang pondered in an article for The Daily Beast, where he is deputy social media editor. The name of the article spells it out. Last Week Tonight does real journalism, no matter what John Oliver says. Aswin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Beaujean is also with us. He's media reporter for Pointer Online. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be here with you.
So let's start with you, Aswin. For those who have not seen Last Week Tonight, what sets John Oliver's show apart from The Daily Show?
Well, the show itself is usually couched in the same subgenre of television, I guess generally referred to as fake news, which of course includes The Colbert Report and The Daily Show. But what makes Last Week Tonight with John Oliver different is not only the long extended 15 to 17 minute pieces they have, which sort of take deep dives into subjects like the death penalty and net neutrality, but the fact that they actually do, despite their insistence that the show is just comedy first and comedy second and has nothing to do with journalism, they do things that do seem an awful like journalistic work. For example, they'll call the State Department to try to get a statement on Sharia law implementation Brunei, or they'll dig through hundreds of pages of tax forms to get to the bottom of claims that the Miss America pageant makes about how much money they give out in scholarships to women. So there is sort of an investigative element to some of their work that I think they're selling themselves short on for a whole host of reasons.
And it is on weekly. There are no interviews, no correspondence. So John Oliver is pretty much the voice of the program.
He is. And there are interviews, like he conducts them himself. For instance, he's interviewed Stephen Hawking for a segment, and he also had, for his very first episode, the exclusive first TV interview with retired General Keith Alexander. And it was the first interview Alexander gave after stepping down as head of the NSA. So, you know, a pretty good get for an HBO half-hour comedy show. Mm.
All right, let's hear an example of one of the stories that you mentioned. This is Last Week Tonight. It's a clip from an episode that aired the week of the Miss America pageant. Let's hear it.
Miss America doesn't just say it's the biggest scholarship organization. It backs this up with numbers.
We're the nation's largest scholarship program for young women, with $45 million made available annually.
$45 million. That is an unbelievable amount of money. As in, I literally didn't believe that. It's the kind of number that can get stuck in your head and rattle around there for days, driving you crazy, making you wish, for instance, there was a way to find out more.
Find out more at missamericafoundation.org.
And that is where all this craziness began.
So they began, Andrew Beaujean. Where did they go? What did they find next?
Well, they started pulling 990s, which are the forms that nonprofits have to file with the IRS. And what they found was that very little of that $45 million that was, you know, notice the word available, was actually getting to people in the form of scholarships.
So as a journalist who follows journalists, is there evidence here that this was more than a comedy bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the kind of thing where, as a journalist, you kind of can't help but wish that you were able to get in on that story and start pulling documents and looking for the dirt.
What other evidence do you hear on the show of there being a real investigative journalism unit working on This Week Tonight?
Well, as Swin mentioned, there are a lot of interviews, you know, interviews that you don't get. There's a lot of what I would call explainer journalism, which is, you know, an underrated and really important part of journalism. He takes on topics the U.S. media barely touches, the Indian general election, for example, or the right to be forgotten, or native advertising. LGBT rights in Uganda. You know, there's a rich vein of stories that are being missed by other outlets that he's really laying out for U.S. viewers.
So, Asawin, would you say that Miss America segment was an example of successful investigative journalism?
Well, it certainly dabbled a little bit, and it sort of admits by the end of it. John Oliver says that this is as far as we got because we got to this point 30 minutes before we had to tape this segment. So
yes,
they were sort of having fun with it, and they didn't dive in it to the way that, say, Andrew or I or one of our colleagues would. But, for example, when I asked Eric Wemple, who's the media reporter at the Washington Post, about the Miss America segment, he said to me, and I quote, "The pageant thing scarcely qualifies as anything but journalism."
Hmm. He admits he's working on Deadline. What does John Oliver say? Does he think this is journalism?
No. He and his staff categorically deny that they're a journalistic operation or organism by any standard. There could be many reasons for that, but I guess the main reason is the same way Jon Stewart of The Daily Show will never say that he's in any way, shape, or form a newsman, and he's just a comedian. Because the second you say you're committing random acts of journalism, you have to assume all the responsibilities and the standards of a journalist and what comedian or comedy writer wants to do that.
Mm.
So, you know, it's an interesting dodge.
The show does have a journalistic fact checker, senior news researcher Charles Wilson. Now, he's an alumnus of the New York Times and the New Yorker. Andrew, watching this, do you think that John Oliver is hiding behind this kind of protection of comedy?
No, I don't think so. I think that it just points to the fact that we really need to be a lot more Catholic in our definition of what is and what isn't journalism now. I think that that's, you know, like race, an increasingly meaningless distinction in U.S. public discourse. There are definitely things that a journalistic operation that wasn't a comedy show would have done differently there. Like, they probably would have tried to get in touch with the Miss America people. But, you know, I found it to be almost like a really good blog post in the way that, you know, they were reporting right up to Deadline. They just shot out what they had and left it out there for other people to pick up.
Well, not only did the show break the story on Miss America scholarship claims, but it also included a call to action. Let's hear that.
But it does seem that two things are true. One, Miss America gives out way less than $45 million in scholarships. And yet, two, whatever the number is, one thing does still seem to be troublingly true.
The Miss America organization is actually the largest provider of scholarships to women in the world.
Yeah, because even their lowest number is more than any other women-only scholarship that we could find. More than the Society of Women Engineers, whose website is here. More than the Patsy Mink Foundation, here. And more than the Jeanette Rankin Women's Scholarship Fund, here. All of which you can donate to if you want to change the fact that currently the biggest scholarship program exclusively for women in America requires you to be unmarried with a mint-condition uterus and also rewards working knowledge of buttock adhesive technology, which is just a little bit unsettling.
So what do you think there, Andrew? What are your thoughts on the kind of advocacy element of the show?
Well, you know, the thing that just occurs to me is it's been a couple weeks. I'd like somebody to get in touch with those organizations and see if they saw any uptick in donations.
So he is. He's playing a comedian. He's playing a journalist. He's playing a pundit in this case, asking for, making a call to action. Is he trying to do too much?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the overwhelming critique that we've seen of the media in the internet age is that we do too little. And I think his own show is a big comment on that. So I don't have any problem with him going from one end of the story to a side that would freak out a lot of journalists, like actually saying, like, here are some other organizations, donate to them.
You know, the Miss America pageant is one thing. Last Week Tonight also tackles heavier topics. I'm thinking of the U.S. drone program. Now, here's a clip. This is from the September 28th episode.
Look, it is completely natural for us not to want to think about the consequences of our drone program. But when children from other countries are telling us that we've made them fear the sky, it might be time to ask some hard questions. The problem is, after a week of looking at this, it seems there are shockingly few available answers. In fact, the best summation we could find of the framework we use to authorize and justify drone strikes is from this former Defense Department advisor.
Right now, we have the executive branch making a claim that it has the right to kill anyone anywhere on Earth at any time for secret reasons based on secret evidence in a secret process undertaken by unidentified officials. That frightens me.
Yeah, it probably does frighten you, because what you just described sounds fucking terrifying.
Well, Andrew, what do you think? Is there a danger to trying to tackle foreign policy in a 15-minute segment, you know, by people who aren't professional journalists? I mean, they could get in hot water.
Yeah, they could. And I thought the drone story was an interesting example of that. You know, I was watching that with my wife, who's a British citizen. And I think, you know, as kind of a side note, one of the best things about the Oliver show is it's an argument for diversity. Obviously, he's also a white male, but he's a foreigner, and he brings a perspective you might not always get. When we were watching that show, I was really struck by our different takeaways. You know, she was a lot more outraged than I was, and mm-hmm. it's just a good reminder that when you have people doing TV, doing journalism, who come from a different cultural background, you're going to get some different takes that you might not get normally from a more homogenous media.
If John Oliver did take off the comedy mask and said, yes, we're journalists, this is a show about, you know, we're exposing the truth, we're speaking truth to power, would the show have to change?
I don't think it would. In fact, the a professor who the AP interviewed about the show and the Miss America segment dubbed it, I believe, investigative comedy. Hmm. So I don't think the show would have to change that much in terms of what it is. It would just be a change in branding and maybe acknowledgement of what the three of us seem to believe it is.
What do you think, Andrew, if John Oliver took off that comedy mask and said, okay, this is a journalistic show, would it have to change?
Oh, I mean, who'd want to watch that, right? We already got The Guardian for stuff that we should be reading but don't want to. I think it's much better that this stays in the realm of entertainment.
Well, Andrew, you alluded to this earlier, but I'd love to hear both of your takes. Does John Oliver's success now expose anything about the limitations of more traditional journalism?
I mean, this came up with The Daily Show and The Colbert Report and even Real Time with Bill Maher all the time. Like, what is it saying about us that Americans are turning to comedy shows more to get their news? I think that stuff is generally overblown. All the flaws with, like, more traditional news media, I don't think Last Week Tonight is stepping on their turf. It's its own thing.
Andrew, what do you think? Has comedy become a more effective way of communicating journalism, of communicating stories?
You know, it's an interesting thing because the whole show is kind of a meta comment on television journalism and how little context it can generally provide, which is why the one thing that I'd really like to see them do less of is rely on TV reports as narrative devices, you know, to kind of move the story forward the way that, you know, crummy Hollywood movies always do.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see them try to bring in some other forms of journalism, and I don't know what forms that would be, but I'm sure the good people at HBO have the money and person power to be able to give that some kind of thought, the kind of stuff that doesn't always, you know, show you somebody sitting in front of a holodesk saying something that may or may not be true.
Andrew Bojan, media reporter for Pointer Online, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Aswin Soopsang, deputy social media editor at The Daily Beast, thank you.
It's been real. Thank you.
We have a link to read Aswin's article, Last Week Tonight, Does Real Journalism, No Matter What John Oliver Says? It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Now, if you remember, Andrew Bojan mentioned that he'd like to know whether any of John Oliver's calls to action have had any real-world effect. In his segment on Miss America scholarship claims, Oliver suggested giving to a few different organizations that offer women-only scholarships without making a swimsuit competition an eligibility requirement. One of the groups that he mentioned is the Society of Women Engineers. We followed up with the organization, which offers scholarships to women pursuing careers in engineering. Here's CEO and Executive Director Karen Hording.
We saw a huge amount of traffic to our website and also an increase in donations. We had almost 45,000 in donations in just a couple of days. In terms of individual giving, that's probably more than a quarter of what we would do in a full year.
Now, having benefited from what's being called the John Oliver bump, we asked Karen what she thought about the show's investigative comedy and that divide between journalism and entertainment.
It's it's definitely more of an entertainment type show. But what we're doing here at the Society of Women Engineers is very serious. So for us, what started out as something perhaps maybe more light turned into something very positive for, you know, a serious problem that the country has, which is not enough women pursuing these sorts of careers.
Karen Horting there, CEO and Executive Director of the Society of Women Engineers. There's more on her organization and on the John Oliver Bump at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we're going to uncover a growing trend among the DIY set, IKEA hacking. Get your Allen wrench ready when Word of Mouth continues after a break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you've ever purchased a set of shelves, say, from IKEA, you know the drill. You follow the detailed instructions, and in a few hours, maybe a few tantrums later, you'll wind up with a set of reasonably priced and reasonably sturdy shelves. What happens if you don't follow that script? 99% Invisible's Roman Mars enters the world of IKEA hacking.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
IKEA hacking is what we've been doing.
And this is friend of the show, Sean Cole. And yes, he said IKEA hacking.
I feel good about it. It feels a little bit subversive and a little bit bourgeois.
You've probably heard of IKEA hacking. It's the practice of buying stuff from IKEA and then re-engineering it, hacking it, into customized, more functional, and often just way better designed stuff. In Sean's case, that stuff is 3 5-foot-high shelves.
Shelves from IKEA. We've laid them down on their sides.
He is drilling and screwing and bolting together one big, beautiful, queen-sized storage bed.
Wrench and bolts.
This is Sean's partner in crime, IKEA hacker Jonathan Bean.
4 bolts and 1 wrench.
He's an assistant professor at Bucknell University. Back in 2009, he co-wrote a serious academic paper about IKEA hacking with Daniela Rossner, who now teaches design at the University of Washington. And they got interested in part because of how bendable the term IKEA hacking is.
It could be anything from, I bought this shelf at IKEA and it was an inch too long for my closet, so I cut an inch off of it.
Or it could be where you just take, say, a salad bowl and make it into a light.
And this is Daniela.
Right, that's not even actually changing the object itself, that's just changing its use.
And the hackerati aren't just diverse in terms of their sensibility, they're diverse in the most basic way possible.
The locus of the IKEA hacking movement is a website called IKEAHackers.net.
You see hacks posted from all over this country and from Australia, Russia, Israel, Dubai. Someone posted a hack that's a French country house library in an actual French country house. He has these before and after pictures and explained all how he did it. And make no mistake, the actual posts themselves, the showing your work, that's a huge part of this whole thing. Because this is the thing. IKEA, in spite of itself, is the great leveler.
Because everything's exactly the same at IKEA, no matter where you are, it sort of lowers the barriers to recreating something. If you go and buy a stud, a wood stud at a Home Depot in the U.S., it's going to be 1.5 by 3.5 inches. If you go and buy a wood stud at Bauhaus, which is a German home improvement store, it's going to be a different size.
I mean, clearly IKEA exists, right, in these various parts of the world. So if I posted an IKEA hack in Boston and someone in the Netherlands saw it, they could probably reproduce it using this, you know, the pieces at their local store, much like a Lego kit.
And it's that very homogeneity, that McDonald's-like sameness from place to place to place, that's what's allowing this global community of hackers to thrive.
Okay, this is the best part, actually. We're about to drill unsanctioned holes into a piece of IKEA furniture.
You're not going to be able to take it back after
this. That's fine.
You want to have at it?
Actually, yeah. May I do the honors?
Sure.
So why is this your favorite part?
I mean, I think that it's just that for the longest time, you know, you're told that drilling holes where they're not supposed to go is destructive and wrong. And we were doing that, and it's still transgressive and you're crossing a boundary, but it's not destruction anymore. It's creation. You know, it felt like for once I wasn't just saying, what's out there? You know, which one on the menu do I want? We were making what we wanted.
Yeah, but you were still shopping at IKEA.
True.
All right, this is the final touch. We're going to put the mattress onto my new IKEA bed. It fits! Oh, boy, it's a bed! It's a bed! It's a real bed!
It's so comfortable.
99% Invisible was produced this week by Sean Cole with Sam Greenspan, Katie Mingle, Avery Truffleman, and me, Roman Mars. We are a project of KALW and distributed by PRX. More at 99pi.org.
Up next, from Grumpy Cat to the Honey Badger, animals are popular fodder for memes. Word of Mouth continues with a look at what happens when your pet goes viral despite your best intentions. We'll find out after the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine this. You take a cute or funny photo of your pet. You upload it to the social media site of your choice. Maybe you show it to friends and they all comment on how adorable it is. And then you move on to other things. Meanwhile, in the deep recesses of the internet, someone sees this photo and decides to caption it. Maybe they give your pet a new name. And suddenly your adorable dog or cat is the next big thing on the internet. A viral meme. You may even get offered a deal from an ad agency that would make your pet a star in the real world. For some, it sounds like a dream come true. But for one woman, it felt much more like a nightmare. Carl Cheka wrote, "Wow, scare, amaze. That's what it's like when your pet goes viral," for Matter.com. Kyle, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right, so bring us back to the beginning and describe this Doge meme for those who have not seen it.
So the Doge meme is this very funny photo of a Shiba Inu dog, which is a breed of dog that's native to Japan. And in every image of this meme, there's a photo of a Shiba Inu, and then on top of the photo, there are these strange phrases written in Comic Sans typeface, like, "Wow, such a maze, so scare." And they kind of narrate what people think the dog might be saying or thinking.
So they're kind of monologue captions of the dog, but I would say done in the, let's say, lowest common denominator of cultural stereotype of how Japanese people talk?
It could be seen that way. I think I'm not convinced that it's totally connected to Japanese people. I think it's more of a goofy kind of lolcat type of talking. You know, kind of the baseline of internet humor, let's say. This is a silly, agrammatical form of writing.
And it's turned into a viral meme. You see the dog's face kind of photoshopped onto a Twinkie or a giant rock or a landscape or a Christmas sweater. But give us the origin story on this. How did it start?
The origin story of Doge is really interesting because the actual dog that appears in the original Doge photo, her owner had no idea that this meme actually existed. So this woman who lives outside of Tokyo named Atsuko Saito is a kindergarten teacher, and she rescued a Shiba Inu dog from a puppy mill. And so she lived with this dog happily, and she started this blog of photos of the dog. And she just posts photos of her and the dog, who's named Kobozu, playing outside and frolicking in the park and, you know, doing all sorts of things. And then one day she took this single photo of Kobozu sitting on the couch, kind of paws crossed, glaring balefully out at the viewer. And that image kind of went forth from Atsuko's blog and went totally viral. No one knows exactly how, but it showed up on 4chan and Reddit and all these different internet community sites. And over time, that single image evolved into the Doge meme, which kind of transforms Kobozu the dog into a wacky cartoon character.
What was Atsuko's response when she saw her dog all over the internet?
At first, Atsuko was totally freaked out. When I originally told her that this meme existed, she said she had seen these weird photos of Kobozu showing up, but had no idea what they meant. And so in talking to her, I realized that she was just totally scared that an image from her private life, like a photo that she shot within her own home, went totally viral and millions of people all over the internet could see it. And I think it scared her a little bit that Kobozu, the dog, had this other life that she didn't know about at all.
But her dog was already pretty internet famous, let's say, in Japan. She had a blog featuring photos of her pets, got a small but devoted fan base. Why did she find this memification of her dog so freaky, as you say?
Let's see. I mean, I think Atsuko was comfortable with her blog because she knew she could completely control it. And the photos that she posted were always very cute and nice. And I think when she started seeing the meme images of Kobozu's head photoshopped onto weird things like we've been talking about, it seemed more frightening than cute, I think. Something I heard a lot from her and her fans was that they didn't think these images of Doge were cute at all. They thought they were actually kind of freaky and frightening. So I think in some sense she realized she had lost control over what she had put online.
You broke the story on Verge. You found her, you tracked her down and presented her with this. It seems like an object lesson on things taking on a life of their own on the internet, you know, out of her control. So if you were her, if you were Atsuko's PR agent, what would you recommend she do?
I mean, I think she could react in one of two ways. The first is to totally ignore it and just hope it goes away. And just not deal with this Doge meme on the U.S. internet, which is pretty separate from her day-to-day life. Or she could kind of go with the flow and realize that Doge is a pretty harmless thing. It's a funny internet meme and a joke that a lot of people really love. And she could actually embrace it and turn Kobozu into kind of an even more famous dog.
So Atsuko was frightened, clearly, by the amount of attention she got, but she also got some offers to make money off of this. Did she take them up?
I think her initial reaction was that she didn't want anything to do with the commercial offers, which came from dog food brands and dog leash companies and even a kind of card game accessory company. But Atsuko is a super nice human being. And her main goal with promoting Kobozu online is to actually raise awareness for or against puppy mills. So in the end, she took some of these commercial offers and has licensed her image to be used commercially in order to donate more money to dog charities in Japan.
Is the Doge meme still popular?
I think the Doge meme is popular. You still see it popping up in different places on the internet. But its popularity is definitely waning. I think internet memes always have kind of a half-life after which they fall out of popularity. And Doge's popularity actually peaked right around the time that that I published that first article on Kobozu's identity. So after that, which was around December 2013, it's definitely fallen off. You can see in like the Google search results or the search metrics that less people are interested in Doge. But I think if you're on the internet enough, you still see those weird photos of Shiba Inu and the strange speech patterns popping up all over the place.
Thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Kyle Chaik is a freelance writer for Newsweek, Matter, Pacific Standard, among other publications. We found his article, Wow, Scare, Amaze. That's what it's like when your pet goes viral, on Matter.com. You'll find a link to his article and see the Doge memes for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. DJ, producer, and electronic musician Juan McLean has also developed a fiercely loyal international fan base. He's performed at clubs across the world. But when he's not jet-setting around the globe, he lives under the radar in New Hampshire. A conversation with Juan McLean when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
track, a place called space conjures up the neon lights, the white linen suits, and high-speed chases of Miami Vice. But while its 80s-inspired dance beat may seem at home in the clubs of Ibiza, it was conceived right here in the wilds of New Hampshire by Juan McLean. Juan's a DJ and producer and electronic musician and the creative force behind the Juan McLean with Nancy Wang. Their third album, In a Dream, has just been released and is getting a lot of love from music critics. Pitchfork Media described the album as high-def synth boogie, flexing and preening in ways its forebears simply couldn't. And Stereo Gum said McLean's latest is more varied and omnivorous than anything else the Juan McLean has done before. And I'm really pleased that it brings Juan McLean to our studio. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're an electronic musician. You've got gigs all over major U.S. cities, U.S. capitals. You're heading off to a European tour in November. Yet you're living in Dover, New Hampshire. Are you leading a double life?
Yeah, I do. I do lead somewhat of a double life. For someone like me, it's typical that I would live in, you know, New York or Berlin or somewhere like that. But I actually live
in a really beautiful apartment.
Yeah, in an amazing apartment, maybe with a doorman. But I actually live in Dover, New Hampshire, and I have since 1999.
So how'd that happen?
I was in between music careers, and my girlfriend at the time was pregnant with our first child, and her family lived in York in Maine, and my parents lived a little bit north of Boston. So we moved from Providence, Rhode Island, up here to be closer to them.
So does living so close to a rural environment, to the natural world, do anything for your creative process?
Yeah, I've actually thought a lot about this over the years because there, I definitely go through phases where I wish I were living in New York. And I think that living in an area like this gives me a lot of sort of breathing room. I think if I lived in a more urban environment like New York or London or Berlin, I would get really caught up in, you know, the frenzy of the city. And being here allows me to sit back a little bit more and, like, not have all those influences coming at me all the time.
Do your neighbors know what you do?
No, it's funny. I felt like I was hiding out here for a long time, and then
like that guy from The Sopranos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly, for less nefarious reasons. But they every once in a while, someone would stop me, like on the street. Someone would say, "Hey, what are you doing in this area? Like, are you on your way somewhere and stop by or something?" And I'd tell them that I live here, and they wouldn't believe it, basically.
Well, you are known as an electronic musician and DJ, but in the early 90s, you were a guitarist in a band called Six Finger Satellite. Now, you were on Sub Pop Records.
Same
people may know that as the same label that signed Nirvana. Let's just hear a little bit of that music from that time. So that's really different from the first track that we heard. Can you talk a little bit about your creative evolution from this, you know, post-punk to dance music?
Well, it's funny because I think of it as just sort of a 180 reversal of very similar elements. Because post-punk had a lot of, like, disco and dance and funk influences. It was a lot of, like, disco rhythmic backbeats with really angular guitars and electronics as well. And so Six Finger Satellite was like a post-punk band with dance elements, and the Juan McLean is like a dance music oriented project coming from a punk rock background.
How about from playing instrument though to, you know, working on keyboards and working with turntables, doing the DJ thing?
Yeah, that I've managed to get around the limitation that the only instrument I know how to play is guitar.
Really?
So I basically play keyboards with like two fingers. And when we play live, I actually have a series of color-coded tape and numbers on my keyboard, so I remember what to play. But that was part of what made it interesting for me, because I was really not interested in having a music career anymore after Six Finger Satellite. But sort of getting into this world of electronic music production made the whole thing like exciting and interesting for me again.
Well, listening to what you do now, it seems like you have a pretty eclectic musical background. I'm wondering what you grew up listening to. What were the things that kind of penetrated the most deeply?
It's funny. I was really into music from a young age. And of course, it's always the music that your parents have lying around. Well, it was back then. I mean, I'm 46. And we didn't have the internet in the 70s. So I remember actually that Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water
was my first
record I was obsessed with, which is really pretty dark for like an 8-year-old or 10-year-old.
Playing it on the family console?
Yeah, it was one of those things you lifted up the lid and put the record in.
Yeah.
And when I started making music as the Juan McLean, when I was making my first bits of music, I discovered that you could, by using only the black keys on the keyboard, you could play the melody to the song Bridge Over Troubled Water. And I don't, so actually my entire first album is made using only the black keys on the keyboard.
Wow.
Because of that. So it's one of those funny things that this very early influence kind of crept back in.
Well, now you've sampled everyone from like Yoko Ono to Daft Punk. I even heard a little Stevie Nicks somewhere, I think.
Yeah, I'm a huge Fleetwood Mac fan. And Nancy is too.
Nancy Wang, that's your creative partner in the Juan McLean.
Right.
Wonderful vocalist. She used to be with the LCD Sound System.
Yep.
But playing as a musician, you're also, you know, a live music. And I'm now wondering what, as a DJ, how you compare that kind of performance aspect.
Well, DJing actually is a performance. I think there are a lot of people who think that you're basically like a human jukebox, like maybe just pressing play on something and listening to a song. But especially for someone like me, like I still play vinyl records when I DJ. And in the process of getting those like two records to work together is a very sort of physical thing and dynamic process that's a lot like, you know, playing an instrument.
I imagine that a lot of bands, you know, they typically want all eyes on them. And as a DJ, are you looking for a different response? I mean, are you casting out and looking at the throngs kind of moving to see how that's going?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interactive, well, it should be a very interactive process. And I really like being, you know, right there in the thick of it when I'm DJing. It's a very utilitarian thing. I mean, you're there basically to make people dance.
Hmm.
And that's something that I really liked about it. Coming from an indie rock background where I got really used to looking out, and, you know, even during your best shows, you're looking out over like 1,000 people with their arms folded watching you.
It must be pretty powerful, though, to command so many people. I mean, they're all responding to you.
Yeah, and it's I find it both more gratifying when it's going very well to DJ than playing live. And it's also the most demoralizing when it goes badly. Like every once in a while, I'll end up back in my hotel room after I've DJed and it's not gone well, like on my laptop researching graduate schools. like I just don't want to do this anymore.
It's always graduate school.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to some more music from the Juan McLean. This is Love Stops Here.
Memories by
I'm hearing a little more New Order than Simon and Garfunkel.
But it's funny. It's definitely goes back to early New Order. I mean, I saw New Order live in like 1985, I think.
Wow.
So, yeah. But I actually think they're not that dissimilar. Like, they both evoke this kind of like melancholy tone that I've always been really drawn to.
Well, I want to talk about your melancholy tone. I know that this album was 5 years in the making, and one of your band members, the drummer Jerry Fuchs, had a tragic death in 2009. Mm-hmm. Any correlation there between the melancholy?
I think the melancholy was always there, but it's funny, that song that we just played, Love Stops Here, was started as a kind of tribute to Jerry.
And
it was
really
kind of this, you know, we were actually in the middle of touring when Jerry died in 2009, as touring as a live band, and it of course immediately stopped, and I just picked up with DJing. I really was playing as much as I possibly could and was away from home as much as I could possibly be away from home. And that song kind of started with this idea of, you know, like sitting on airplanes and looking over and where Jerry would usually be sitting next to me, you know, he wasn't there anymore.
Well, I'm thinking of the lyrics of that song and other songs. Let's say electronic dance music is not known for its literary value, necessarily.
Definitely.
You know, the lyrics are almost immaterial. You seem to place a lot of emphasis on the lyrics. Is there something you're wanting to communicate?
Well, Nancy and I talked about this very early on in the Juan McLean, because I remember we came up with a list of things that dance music was usually about lyrically. And it was like party themes, like having a good time, and then sort of abstract things that didn't mean anything. And we made a decision to always write about very personal things, even to the point of it being kind of embarrassing. And it's also, I think, a time, and this might still be true, when irony seemed to be a really cheap crutch that people were using. I mean, both in, you know, song lyrics and even in the literary world. And I was always a bit turned off by that. It always seemed like a bit of a cop-out. I think it's a lot harder to just come out and say something honestly and with integrity, even though you could be opening yourself up to criticism.
Let's hear a little bit more. This is A Simple Design. Nancy Wang here on Lyrics. Achieve emotional resonance in dance music, or sincerity, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to achieve in any genre of music, but particularly in dance or electronic music, because you have this built-in limitation of using electronic instruments, which are hard to coax a kind of emotional feeling out of them, I guess.
Is it ever odd to see people dancing to it, you know, thinking like, wait, this is about the human condition?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. I mean, that's the trick, really, is like, you don't want to be, you know, how do you make something that's still kind of dancey, I guess, or works in a visceral way without just being entirely heady and intellectual?
Juan McLean, it's such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Juan McLean is a DJ, producer, electronic musician, and the creative force behind The Juan McLean with Nancy Wang. Their new album, In a Dream, is available now, and you'll find a link to more, including to listen to some of the tunes on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for listening today. There's much more to hear at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any part of the show, you can catch up by subscribing to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it on iTunes or find the link at wordofmouthradio.org. We invite you to check it out because, like DJ Juan McLean, Word of Mouth feeds off of the environment and generates ideas from right here in New Hampshire. but we're eager to share what we do in the borderless world of the internet. So if you listen to the Word of Mouth podcast, please write a review for it. That helps Word of Mouth swim up to the surface of the deep sea of podcasts. The best local secrets get traction by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Spread it around, and please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.